Good evening, everybody. My name is Chris. I am an alcoholic. It's an absolute honor to be at this group. What a great introduction that was. It had me thinking about that there are some AA meetings that have it, and there are some AA meetings that don't. What is that? What is that quality? And I'm thinking enthusiasm. You know, this group. I know a lot of people in this group. It's funny when you drive 100-some miles from your house and you know a whole bunch of people. That's pretty amazing in itself. But you know, there's a lot of enthusiasm in this group, and I think it's lack of enthusiasm that can really kill us. You know, we'll come to some meetings, and you know, we'll begrudgingly get a sponsor, and we'll be the cookie guy for a while. You know, and it'll be like a castor oil treatment to us, and we'll never really develop any passion for the recovery process. And I see a lot of that passion in this group. And you know, if you are new or coming back, or you've been struggling, you know, you've been struggling, and you haven't really been able to get any sober time, you know, land in a group like this. Your chances are much greater than perhaps other places. I did say that I was an alcoholic. You know, the longer I'm sober, the more I understand, you know, what alcoholism is and what was going on with me. I was a pathetic drunk. I bumped into somebody the other night, and it was really funny. She got up to celebrate 20 years, and she announced her name was Lisa, and then she said that she grew up in my hometown, and then she accidentally gave her age. I did some math, and I realized that, you know, she was maybe 2 years younger than me, and then she started talking about what she did for a living, and I go, oh my God, I know her. I used to drink and party my ass off with this girl. So I go, I hadn't seen her in 30 years. And I go up to her and I start talking to her and I introduce myself and she hugs me. I can't believe it's you. You know, it was beautiful. And then, you know, I was telling her, yeah, I can't, you know, I came in about the same time you did and I was in real trouble. And she goes, you know what I remember about you is you always slurred. And I'm thinking, I always slurred. You know what that means? That means I was always drunk. And this is what she remembers about me. And you know, that was the good side of me, always slurring. You know, and she knew me in my first 5 years of drinking. It got, you know, I drank for 20 years, and it got really, really grim. You know, I know there's a whole lot of people in this room that can understand, but I never recognized alcohol as anything that was a problem. I always recognized alcohol as my solution. Now, I never thought about it intellectually, but I always regarded alcohol as a way to escape, you know, the burden of Chris. And this started at a very early age. The first time I ever got drunk, I was about 12 or 13. I cut school with a couple of my friends, and we went back to my mother's house, and I brought out a bottle of Four Roses whiskey, poured three water glasses, passed them out, and I started drinking. It's the first time I ever drank. Now, the two guys that I was with never became alcoholic. To my knowledge, never became problem drinkers. They had two-thirds of their glass, and that was it. They sat back and watched the show. Because what happened was I drank all of my glass, the rest of theirs, the rest of the bottle, staggered around the house, you know, breaking windows, just acting completely insane. Ended up coming to in a field after being in a blackout for a period of time. I'm like 12. I'm already a blackout drinker. You know, you would think that this might catch your attention. And, you may say, wow, maybe that's not so great. You know, you did things that you probably didn't want to do. There's a whole period of missing time, you know, that you can't account for. And you're in a field not knowing what the hell's going on. And then I got sick, like, you know, the first drunk sick, you're horizontal for a couple of days. And you know, it was absolutely brutal. And I made a fool of myself, and I was deathly ill. You know, why would anybody put themselves through something like that again? And I'll tell you why I became preoccupied with alcohol right after that first time. I always felt uncomfortable with myself. I always had emotional trauma going on inside me. You could call it shyness, anxiety, self-centered fear. You could call it a whole number of things, but basically what it was an inability to feel comfortable in most situations that I was in. I didn't like school. I didn't like crowds. I didn't like authority. I didn't like being told what to do. I didn't like anything, and I found it very, very uncomfortable, and I was mad at all of it. And when I drank from that bottle of Four Roses whiskey, what it did was it relieved me of this emotional, psychic burden. And all of a sudden, I felt like, I can step out now. I'm good. This is great. And the people, I was always worried about what you thought of me. I was totally preoccupied with whatever impression I was making on you. I was, burdened by that. And after drinking that Four Roses whiskey, I couldn't care less what you think. You were lucky to be with me. You know what I mean? Maybe I'll come talk to you later. It was a whole shift in perception. There was so much in that bottle for me. And this doesn't happen to normal people. There were dancing lessons in that bottle. You know what I mean? I drank enough of that stuff. One of the most traumatic experiences in my life as a child was, does anybody remember square dancing in like sixth grade? Okay, the therapists are still making money on this. They would line all the boys up on one side of the gym and all the girls up on the other side of the gym and then blow the whistle. And you were supposed to run across the gym and ask a girl to dance. They didn't know what they were doing to the pre-alcoholics. And I'd drink some of that booze and I'd wait for them to come ask me. It did so much for me. It relieved me of so much of that self-centered fear that I don't care how ill I was. I don't care how stupid I looked. I needed to start using this as a tool, and I became very preoccupied with it. And I started to think, I was 12, the drinking age was 21, so, there was logistical challenges. But I started to figure out, how to get it, who I'm going to drink it with, what it's going to be. It's certainly not going to be Four Roses. And I started experimenting with the Boone's Farm apple wine, the 14-year-old drink. But I started to use this alcohol, and I used it in a different way. I drank with a lot of people who'd have a couple of drinks, and then they'd say, "No thanks, I've had enough." You ever drink with them? Isn't it really annoying? You had enough. It's only 10:30. Let's go to the city, Come on. You crazy. It was a whole nother deal for me. And I slowly started to hang out with the people where this would be acceptable, The people in the glee club, and the science club were usually not the people. I hung out with the people that didn't really have names, We congregate in the dark areas of the smoking lounge before school. Now, I must say that I started drinking in the late 60s, and so I started blossoming into an alcoholic in the very early 70s, and anybody that's from that era knows that, there were certain things available very, very easily for you to get your hands on. Some of those things I partook of. I remember the Quaalude epidemic of 72. This made the papers. One of my best friends, came in with a sack of Quaaludes. Anybody that's never done a Quaalude, you eat a Quaalude, it's like drinking 2 6-packs of beer in a minute, You're like, and it's really hard on the furniture, 'cause I'm going to get up and go change the channel, you know, and you ruin all the furniture between you and the TV. But anyway, this guy brings in a sack of these things, and he had got them late the night before, and he'd never done them. You know, his brother told him, go sell these tomorrow. So we all go up, and we go, well, how many do you do? And he goes, three or four, you know. So there's about 50 of us that did like three or four Quaaludes before first period. The ambulance was back and forth all day long. I remember it's about third period, okay? It's about third period, and I'm walking down the hall, like, hanging on to the locker. And I figure, I got to make a break for it, okay? So I see the exit sign, and I make a break. And I bust through the exit door, and I head for the woods. And what I didn't realize is the whole 400 wing is watching me, you know? And they, you know, the next day they said, Chris, it was great watching you head for the woods. Do you know it took you like 10 minutes to go 100 yards? You know? And I thought I was moving. Oh, man. I had some, you know, I don't care what it was. Now, I you know, this is Alcoholics Anonymous, so I want to qualify this. Alcohol was there first, it was there last, and especially in the second half of my drinking, if I used any drugs at all, it was to elongate my drunk or to manage my hangover. You know, it revolved so much around my alcoholic personality. But you know. This one time, this was later on in my drinking, I would wake up with the nerves. You ever wake up with the nerves? It's actually, you know, alcohol detoxification, you know. It's not like anxiety. It's like, you know, you're detoxing. And finally, I couldn't take it anymore. So I went to the doctor. And I went to the doctor. I said, Doc, you know, I'm nervous all the time. And I go, you got anything for that? And the doctor said, yes, we have this new drug on the market. It's called Xanax. And I go, what kind of milligram does that come in? You know, I'm going to need the big ones. And I did. I started eating Xanax. Toward the end, I wasn't even counting them. I was weighing them. And, you know, that's enough. And right on the label, it says, no alcohol, no alcohol, no alcohol. It's like three times as big as the name, you know? And I'd pour them out, and I'd start drinking vodka, chase it with vodka. I got to tell you, you get limber when you do that. You know what I mean? You're not moving too fast. You're also not getting a lot done. You know, you can, like, stare at the test pattern, like, whoa, for, like, 3 hours. And, you know, the crazy thing is I didn't see how much trouble I was in. Inherent in alcoholism is an utter inability, except that very, very few times there's an utter inability to recognize, to have a true perspective on how much trouble you're in. You know, the milkman knows that we're in trouble, you know. And I really, really was hanging on to the idea that I needed this alcohol to cope. I recognized my problems as coming at me, not from me. And one of the things that I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous with these steps is that's not true. My problems don't come at me, they come from me. And it was a misperception to believe that there was a hostile universe out there that I had to deal with by being intoxicated, you know? And for just years and years I drank. Now, it got to the point where I was suffering from a lot of consequences. The early 70s was a time when friends let friends drive drunk, okay? This was prior to all that PR about, you know, driving safe and all that. And we'd walk to the party, get drunk, and go get the keys, you know. And I crashed a lot of cars. I'll tell you my first crash DUI and my last one, and you can figure out the middle. But I totaled 9 cars in drunken blackouts. The first one was, I was at a bar chugging pitchers of beer. Is this social drinking? Have you ever seen, you don't go to a cocktail party and like chug a pitcher of beer. But we were in this bar chugging pitchers of beer. So because I was overserved, I had trouble navigating down this road on the way back from the bar, and the car spun around and hit this bridge abutment going backwards at about 40 miles an hour. I actually got thrown out the back window. I came out of it, and I was looking up, and I was seeing stars. And my legs were still in the car. Now, 3 flat tires, the car's bent like a boomerang. There's not a window left in it. It's toasted, right? But what do you do? You got to go home, So I get back in the car and I start driving, and the drive shaft is slapping the frame. The thing's going whack-a-da-boogada-bam, whack-a-da-boogada-bam, about 2 miles an hour. And I go right by a cop taking radar. He doesn't even pull me over. He walks me over, okay? And he reaches to the window and he starts shaking me. Where'd you have that accident? And I'm like, what accident, officer? There's like glass in my hair. He's like, where are you going? I go, I'm going home. What are you bothering me for? And he goes, where's home? I go, Basking Ridge. He goes, that's 24 miles. Are you out of your mind? You got no tires. You guys are always hassling me. So, the DWI and number one. I'll tell you about my last one. This is many years later. That first DWI, I think I had my license for 2 months, You wonder why the insurance is higher on younger drivers. My last DUI, supposedly I crossed a double yellow. You know how cops are. Supposedly. And I got pulled over. And he comes up to the car and knocks on the window. He goes, license, registration, insurance card. So I roll down, And so I reach into the glove compartment and I'm looking for the license, the registration, the insurance card. And, I'm fumbling and a couple of minutes are going by. Finally, I just give up. And I grab the entire contents of the glove compartment and hand it to the cop, okay? There's maps and flashlights and tissues and everything. And, I told you they're always hassling me. So he gets me out and he makes me do some tests and he goes, you got to go to the station. We're going to give you a DUI test. Takes me to the station. Now, do you remember hazy recollections? You know what I mean by that? Like, you remember it a little bit. Well, here was my hazy recollection the next day. I remember I nailed the ABCs. Has nothing to do with me learning them when I'm 3, But I nailed the ABCs. So they ended up giving me a DUI. So I hire a lawyer. We're going to fight this. This injustice. And I hire a lawyer. Paid $1,500, he's in a suit and tie, and the first thing we have to do is go to the police station to view the video of my sobriety test. Has anyone in here ever seen their video from a sobriety test? Don't do that. Don't. It's disturbing. Okay? Oh, that's an aversion therapy for drinking, I'll tell you. But I didn't know that. I thought I did a great job. So, anyway, the first thing that happens is we ask the cops for the tape, and this was a dead giveaway because when the cop gave my lawyer the video, he sniggered. He was going like, and that was a bad sign. And sure enough, as soon as it comes up on the TV, I am horrified. I am so drunk you can't even imagine. And we get to the ABCs, which I was been bragging about to this lawyer, right? And I nailed them, all right? I nailed them like this. A. B. Can I have a cigarette? C. It was horrible. And there's scenes where literally I'm walking the line, like hanging on to the cop, you know. And, oh, it's just horrible. And that's bad. Now, this whole time, this $1,500 lawyer is, you know, very professional, you know, okay. And I'm like this. And finally, at the end, they go, okay, Mr. Schroeder, you know, the test is over. We're going to turn the camera off in a minute. But is there anything you'd like to add before we turn the camera off? And I thought to myself, oh, no, because I don't remember anything, right? Sure enough, I look at the camera and I go, like this, like, oh, the lawyer loses it. He loses it. He's going, bah! Oh, that's great. I've never seen that before. Bah! If you had any chance at all of being this, oh, boy, you blew it right there. I'm like, I guess we're going to plea this one, right? You know? I walked for 4 years after that, you know? I was figuring there was going to be Jetson mobiles by the time I got my license back. You know, I had some work problems, as you can imagine. Anybody have work problems out there while you're drinking? I became an electrician for some reason. Can you imagine? That is a bad job to have when you go like this every morning, okay? I was constantly blowing myself up, you know. I think the most there's two stories I'll tell you. Well, one of them was, I got to work, and I was working with this guy who really thought I was lame. He was my partner, and he was just, because I was always ill, and I'd forget things, and I'd be disoriented all day long, and, you know, fires would start, and he just hated working with me. And this one day, I get to work, and we're doing a service on the side of the house. We're putting up an electrical meter on the side of the house, and I'm doing the electrical meter, and he's fumbling in the truck, and all of a sudden, I start to get, you know that feeling? And you know you have 7.3 seconds to get somewhere before you lose it. And I look over him, and I don't want him to see me sick, you know. He already thinks I'm really lame, so I know what I'll do. I'll tear around the back of the house. I'll just run around the back where he can't see me. So I run around the back, and I just make it around the back, and whoa! It's like a fire hydrant, you know. And I had been drinking grape drink, you know. So it was like purple. I stuccoed this house with like purple vomit. Just, whoa! And I thought I was alone. But I looked over, and not from here to like the exit sign there was a neighboring deck with a mother, a father, and three kids sitting there having nice tea, and they're looking like, you know, mommy, the purple puke monster from hell, mommy. It was embarrassing. It was embarrassing. Another time, and this sounds too wacky to be true, but I've got to tell you, this happened to me. I'm a maintenance electrician in a department store, like a Macy's or whatever. This is called Epstein's. And I had to drill holes in the floor near the cash registers to run computer lines. So I had this big steel drill with an extension and a big auger bit on it. You know, and it was one of those old things with a locking trigger. Like, what moron would make one of these things with a locking trigger? Well, what happened was, I'm drilling, and it's the lingerie section, okay? So I'm, like, preoccupied, you know? It's a very interesting department. And all of a sudden, the drill hits a beam and catches. I bear down on it. I accidentally lock the trigger, and it starts spinning me around like this. The drill ties me up in the cord, okay? The auger bit rips my pants right off my ass. And it finally unplugs from the wall. And I'm sitting here like this, tied to a drill, all bloodied up, no pants. You know, and all these women are looking at me. These things were forever happening to me. They were forever happening to me. Now, alcoholism gets your attention. If you're lucky and it doesn't kill you, there are times when it gets your attention. And what happens, I believe, is the clouds of delusion part just long enough for you to recognize that you're in trouble and you need to do something. And that happened for me. I had to do some outpatient. I actually did an inpatient treatment program. I went to a 28-day place at one point in time. I ended up drinking after that, which is, who signs themselves into a 28-day program to get away from booze, goes to outpatient to get away from booze, goes to AA to get away from booze, and then tells everybody you're away from booze, and then you drink? Because that's what happened to me. Okay, I really didn't want to drink. I mean, I don't think as alcoholics we can make a decision to put alcohol in our body from a sane state of mind. I think that when the time comes that we pour alcohol down our throat, we're not sane. It says in the second step, restore us to sanity. I believe that's what it means. I also believe that powerless means powerless. So what happened to me was, by the time alcohol had got my attention to the point where I recognized I needed to separate from it and stop drinking it, I was way beyond the point I was going to be able to do that on my own unaided will. I really thought that all I'd need to do is really decide. You know, I mean, Nancy Reagan told me to just say no. So I recognized that just saying no was probably, you know, not going to work. But I figured, you know, sign myself into a rehab, do the outpatient, go to AA, you know, do all this stuff. That should work. And I ended up drinking in the middle of my outpatient going to AA meetings. When I swear, if you would have gone around the room in the meetings that I was going to, I wanted to not drink more than anybody else in that room because it was killing me. I was in the acute stages of it. It had destroyed my life. I'd lost a family, jobs, licenses. You know, I was just drinking to survive at this point in time. And I swear there was no one in that room that wanted to not drink more than me. And I ended up drinking. And this really got my attention because I'm like, oh, my God. I'm like one of those hopeless cases. I was out for about 5 months. My last drunk was interesting. It was Christmas of 1989. I'm home at mom's because that's where you go, you know, once you lost 16 jobs and 12 driver's licenses and your family, you start to think if mom needs any help around the house, you know, and I'm going to go help her out, you know. And so I was at mom's and my brother and my sister come for Christmas, and there's nieces and nephews and there's family animals and, you know, there's presents under the tree and there's Christmas carols and the stockings are hung by the chimney with care and everyone's just having a great time. And I start drinking Johnny Walker Black. Okay, and I'm drinking and I got a resentment, you know. I don't even remember what it was about, but you know those resentments, like, bastards! You know, I threaten my entire family with a .38 caliber handgun, okay? Just in a drunken blackout. Now, this, you know, wasn't exactly the festive atmosphere they were all looking for, you know? And they're like, let's get the hell out of here, you know? And they took their Christmas elsewhere. And I came to like 3 days later. I remember staggering into the kitchen. There was a pile of vodka bottles that went way up in the sink. And I don't even remember buying them. I mean, it was a brutal, brutal drunk. And I was at that jumping off place where it says in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, we can't imagine our life without drinking completely, but we can't imagine keeping going the way we're going. And we wish for the end. It's the jumping off place. And I remember I started the detox. And anybody in here familiar with the DTs? They're a little unnerving, aren't they? There were animals, little animals running around, and there was maggots all over me, and I was hearing marching bands, and, you know, there was things scratching on the house to get in. I was freaking out, you know? But I was at a point where I was not going to drink again. And you know what? I wasn't going to call an ambulance either because I didn't want to look lame. You know what I mean? I mean, anyone in their right mind going through really serious alcohol withdrawal needs to be in a hospital or something. You need to be medicated. But I didn't want the people driving up in the ambulance to think I was a loser. You know? Oh, God. I'm at mom's, by the way. You know? But anyway. Anyway, I get through this horrific, horrific detox. And I got my ass back to AA. I mean, I'd been in the 28-day program. I'd done the outpatient. But there was something I recognized in the group Alcoholics Anonymous. There was a power that I couldn't understand, but there was a lot of people who were talking about how they used to be like me, and they aren't anymore, and that they're recovered. You know, they're in recovery is basically what they were saying back then. So I got real involved. I went back to AA, and I went back with a willingness born of desperation. I mean, I'd have done anything. I mean, I was going to 14 meetings a week. You know, I got a sponsor, Fish Food Phil. You know, I was taking commitments. You know, I'd even be the cookie guy, you know, if you ask me. And whatever. And this is a willingness born of desperation. I just couldn't imagine feeling bad like that anymore. Now, this went on for about a year. I'm going to a ton of meetings, and I'm still a train wreck. Okay, I'm a sober train wreck now, but I'm a train wreck. I still have all that anxiety, that self-centered fear, you know, feeling like it's one more barn dance, you know what I mean? And just like, Chris, how you doing? Fine, you know? Because you can't be honest. You can't say, well, you know, I have feelings of impending doom and, you know, homicidal fantasies and, you know, I'm thinking about buying a semi-automatic. How are you doing? You know, I mean, you can't be honest like that. So you say, fine, and I'm fine, good. And I'm going to a million meetings. Now, all of a sudden, I get a hold of this set of tapes. And these are tapes from one of my friends gave them to me. He was one of those tape guys. And he said, Chris, you're like hardcore. You'll like these. And I didn't really trust that they were going to be any good because he had given me tapes before. And he gave me a series of affirmation tapes before this. You know, he didn't know what he was listening to. He'd just go to the New Age bookstore and buy tapes. Now, you know, and he gave me these affirmation tapes, and I tried it. And it said, stand in front of the mirror and 100 times say, Chris, you're a wonderful guy. And so, Chris, you're a wonderful guy. Chris, you're a wonderful guy. Chris, you're I'm a scumbag, you know. And so I now understand that, you know, trying to treat alcoholism with affirmations is like trying to stop a semi with a cobweb, you know. It's just not effective. Alcoholism is an aggressive illness. It takes an aggressive recovery process. We need to be active. It takes a lot to be able to overcome this because alcoholism is so aggressive. Now, he gives me these tapes, and there's some big book tapes from a couple of guys from Arkansas, and I start listening to them. And here's the message I got. You got to understand, I am the pope of the fellowship at this point in time. I'm going to 12 meetings a week, you know, and I'm the secretary here and, you know, the booker there. I'm doing all this stuff. People are patting me on the head. Hey, Chris, you're doing really good. Yeah. You know? And I'm hating everybody in the meetings, you know? Like, oh, look, he's putting his hand up again. Oh, no. Oh. He's going to share. Oh, no. You know, you know how it is. You know, like, hypocritical business. So I'm a train wreck. And some stuff happens. And, you know, I listen to these tapes. And what these tapes basically said was, you know, Chris, you're operating in one side of the triangle, maybe a little bit in another side. You know, you're engaging in unity. You know, unity is the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it's the meetings, it's getting together. But the recovery part comes from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. It comes from the mechanical spiritual exercise, the spiritual exercises of the 12 steps. Chris, if you're not engaged in this, if you're not trying to actually take these steps, you don't have a program because that's what an AA program is. Don't be mistaken thinking you're working your program by going to meetings. This was the basic message that I got from these tapes. And I had another resentment now. You know, who are these guys from Arkansas telling me this stuff? What, are you kidding me? You know, I'm a good AA member. I'm doing a good job. I'm sober. But the truth haunts you if you're alcoholic. And I got to tell you, I still was restless, irritable, and discontented on a good day, suffering from misery, depression, remorse, self-centered fear, and guilt on a medium day. And a bad day was terror, frustration, bewilderment, despair, pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. You know, that was a bad day. And that was me sober going to 12 meetings a week, okay? So some stuff happened in my life. Another bottom I hit. And once more, there was a willingness born of desperation. And I started listening to these tapes. And I opened a big book. There really was no one in my area that was actually doing the steps from the book Alcoholics Anonymous at that time. At least I didn't know any. And I still really haven't met any. But anyway, they are now. I mean, you know, from back then. Anyway, so I started going through the book. And when it said, you know, we put these people or institutions down in black and white that with whom we hated, you know, I would stop and I would write this out. And I actually started to take the steps. And here's what I found out. I found out that the internal condition that's alcoholism, and it manifests itself emotionally and spiritually. It manifests itself in the general feelings of uncomfortability that we have, our inability, our lack of dealage. It manifests in a lot of different ways. And it says in the book that alcohol was but a symbol. Okay? The causes and conditions of our alcoholism are basically that we built a life system based on selfishness and self-centeredness. Everything's about us. We may not be much, but we're all we think about. You know? How's this going to affect me? You know? So-and-so died on me. You know, everything's about us, you know. And we've built this as alcoholics. And this is a bad operational platform, okay? You can do nothing but shoot yourself in the foot time after time with this kind of an operational methodology. Now, what happens is, as I started to go through the steps, there was a behavior and an attitudinal modification process that was going on. I didn't recognize really what was happening to me because I was just too sick. I was just insane. But what was happening was a healing process was going on. And what it was doing was it was healing my spirit. It was healing my emotional condition. It was healing my ineffectual behavioral processes. And what happened was, from a foundation of selfishness and self-centeredness, I started to move over toward a foundation of love, service, and compassion. It was a shift in perception that was happening as I was going through these steps. And when I got to the other side, I recognized recovery for what it is. There's a lot of there's a lot of wonderful promises in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a lot of promises that we miss. Here's one of them. The best years of your life are ahead of you. That's a great promise, isn't it? Frequent contact with newcomers is the highlight of your life. I didn't understand that until I got through the steps because I hated newcomers. You know? Oh, God, he's going to raise his hand and he's going to share. Oh! But, you get through the steps and, you know, it's like, wow, here's somebody that, you know, I can do a little 12-step work. Maybe I can improve this guy's situation a little bit. The craziest thing that I found through the steps is, you know, if you want to have everything that you possibly could want in your life, wouldn't you think that you got to go out and grab it? You know, I read all those self-help books, like, you know, Winning Through Intimidation, you know, Hide a Dagger Behind the Smile, you know, How to Take Advantage of Cripples. You know, I mean, you know, all those wonderful self-help books. You know, Get Rich and, you know, Wipe Out the Financial Fortunes of Your Neighbors. You know, wouldn't you think if you really wanted it all that you got to go out there and take it? Well, I found through the actual practice of these steps that if you want everything that you can imagine in your life, what you need to do is find ways to give. Find ways to express a compassionate perspective. Find ways to help people who are in less of a sound situation than you are. And you know, it's through this process that I started to heal. Now, I was sponsoring early on. This is prior to the steps. Can you imagine? Some of them are even still alive. I found out if you learn how to give good share, you know, you can, you know, every once in a while somebody will be sick enough to say, oh, what will you have? You want to come live with me and Mom? You know. But I was actually sponsoring people, and they were drinking on me. A lot of them were drinking on me. You ever have them drink on you? Isn't that terrible? Doesn't that make you look bad? You know what I mean? It's like, is Harry yours? You know, he's drinking and he's hitting on the new women. And... yeah, Harry's mine. I'll talk to him. And this was happening to me a lot. Now, I had just gone through the steps, you know, in the big book, and really it was the wonderful thing about these spiritual exercises is you don't have to do them perfectly. You know, we get a pass fail on our willingness and the actual movement through these. You know, I've seen some pathetic four steps, you know, from some of the people that I sponsored, and yet, you know, it worked for them because it was the best they could do. So you know, I had done the best I could do with limited understanding, but I had started to heal. So, you know, these guys were drinking on me, so I thought, you know what? I'm going to bring them over to my house. I'm going to open up the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and we're going to start going through the book. And when there's an instruction, we're going to do the instruction. When there's a prayer, we're going to do the prayer. We're going to do this like it's a textbook. You know, the book Alcoholics Anonymous is a textbook. So many people forget that in AA today. I mean, you know, you go into meetings and it's like big book, schmig book. You know? But think about this. Let's say you were a calculus major. How good do you think you would do if you never read the calculus book, never did the problems, but went to class to share about calculus? No. Oh, calculus is great. Love that calculus. I'm grateful for calculus. No. You can't solve any problems that way. You know what I mean? The same thing with the book Alcoholics Anonymous. You don't do the work. You can't solve any problems in your life. You know, you can't access that power that will help you rebuild your life. It's like people that would go to an airport and hang out in the terminal and talk about flying. You know, there's a 727. Boy, those babies are beauts. You know, and never get on a plane. Yeah, I love this flying stuff. Get on a plane! Now, one of the other things that I discovered after going through this, and I started to go after all the big book tapes at that point. I discovered Joe Hawk and, you know, Mark H. I discovered all these people who were just dynamite big book people, you know. And I became a big book evangelist. You ever meet any of them? You know, here's what they do in a meeting after they've gone through the steps. You people were trying to kill me! Why didn't you tell me about this? It's in the book! And I started to upset some people. And, you know, I got to tell you, the people sober 20, 30 years are just like, you know. And here's what happens. You get evangelical. I mean, when you're reborn through these steps, you know, it's a natural thing to be exuberant about it all. Hopefully, though, you mature through that and you get a little tact and common sense. You know, this one guy I was working with was going up to all the old timers going, "You're killing those, you're killing your sponsors!" And he was warning, "Get rid of him, he's going to kill you!" That may be true, but I think it was a violation of the first tradition or something, you know? Did not really do the unity of the group much good. Anyway, I started taking these guys through the steps. And here's what I found out, and this is really significant, at least for me. Please, Alcoholics Anonymous is experiential. You can learn a lot intellectually. You can read the book. You can listen to people share. But the only way to really learn in Alcoholics Anonymous is experientially. That's from your own experience, not your own intellect. Now, here's what I learned experientially after working with a whole bunch of guys. I took maybe a dozen guys through the book in the first couple of years that I was doing this work. Every single one of them that did the fourth step, the fifth step, the eighth and the ninth, started the disciplines of prayer and meditation and actually went out and worked with other people. Actually is a great word to put in front of all of these, by the way. Anyway, that actually went out there and did that. They are all still sober today. They're card-carrying AA members in good standing. They're working with other people. And here's the great part. Their quality of life is out into the stratosphere. They are living incredible lives. And they continue to stay in the trenches in AA helping people. But when you look at their quality of life, it's extraordinary compared to where they were. Now, what would happen with the people who would balk? Because, remember, I said enthusiasm is not always granted to us. Sometimes we just aren't enthusiastic enough to come in here and do this stuff. We think it's an overreaction to a problem we really have under control. And, you know, sometimes maybe we do. Sometimes maybe we don't. We end up tongue-chewing, knee-walking, not able to operate our own pants zipper drunk again. But the people that didn't get through these things, here's what I saw happen. Because they didn't put enough into the recovery process, they didn't get enough power back from Alcoholics Anonymous and God to be able to stay. And they drifted away. They weren't going to do the ninth step. That doesn't make any sense to me. Pay the money back. You know, and because of that lack of attention to detail, thank you. Because of that lack of attention to detail, there wasn't enough power to hold them into the fellowship. And what happens is, once more, we become insane. We think that we can manage our own life. We think that, you know, it's not going to get us. You know, we're good. And they drifted away. A whole lot of times these guys have come back in that I work for. Oh, Chris, you were right. It's been hell. It's been horrible. Well, you know, what are you going to do? Each of us has a road that we're gonna be walking on. some of us are able to grasp that enthusiasm and be able to get through this work. Now, why I like groups like this is, I said it earlier, your chances of making it are better in a group like this because there's so many people that are enthusiastic. There's so many experienced sponsors. The biggest problem in AA today is a combination of poor sponsorship and uninformed group members. Those two things, if those two problems were solved, there would be no more problems in Alcoholics Anonymous today. But our statistics are shrinking. You know, the success rates have gone down for a long time. I think there's a renaissance that Joe and Charlie started in the late 70s. I think it's alive and well. I think the book Alcoholics Anonymous, people are paying renewed respect to that book and much more attention to the details in that. I think that's all well and good. I went from being a really bad electrician to working my way up through the facilities management field. Some of the things that are going on in my life today, this has been an extraordinary year for me. 2008 has been an extraordinary year for me. I took a leap of faith in January, and I said, you know, there was this startup opportunity, and it revolved around the addictive illness field, not as a counselor or, you know, somebody working in a rehab, but more on the media side of what's going on as a whole globally with addictive illness. And I got this opportunity to jump into a startup. And basically the deal was, you know, you make this happen and there'll be some money at the end of the road. And I was at a point in my recovery where I just trusted God with this. And I had never gotten to this point before, but I said, you know what, God, I'm going to help your kids. You've got to take care of the finances. You know, I mean, I'm really hoping that some money is going to come, but I have to take my attention off of that to be able to do this. I'm going to do this, and I'm just going to see what will happen. What's the worst that can happen? I've lived with Mom before, you know, so So I did that. I took the leap, and I became a media director for a company called C4 Recovery Solutions. And, you know, I'm flying all over the world. I'm interviewing the people who have started treatment processes and started AA in other countries. And it's really, really interesting. The people I'm meeting are absolutely extraordinary. And going into it, you know, I'm a big book guy, right? I'm going to be dealing with these rehab people. I'm going to be telling them a thing or two. You know, they don't know what they're doing. What I found out was there was nothing to argue with these people about. The real top-of-the-line clinicians, the real top-of-the-line people, they're, you know. They get it. They understand that this is a spiritual and physical illness. They understand it, but they see treatment as something on the continuum to permanent sobriety. You know, treatment is part of that continuum for a lot of us. And if you do a really good job with treatment, it makes it more conducive to get into the recovery part that we all have to continually practice the rest of our lives. And so I couldn't even argue with these people, and that was really amazing. You know, I was able to move to a bigger house. You know, my mother got really sick, and because I could do my own hours, I was able to be there for her all the time in the hospitals and arrange the nursing homes. And listen, I was the brother. I have a brother and sister. I was the guy that, you know, being asked to come speak at a thing like this is amazing for me, because in the 1980s, nobody asked me to say anything. They told me to shut up. You know, will you just shut up? And nobody ever asked me, you know, would you just go somewhere else? We don't care where you go, just go, get out of here. I mean, that's what I was hearing. So I'm now the type of family member who can be counted on, and I'm a go-to guy with the family. Hey, you know, what do you think? And I'm helping them make these big decisions because they recognize something in me that's of sane and sound mind today. And you know, I got to tell you that's absolutely remarkable. I was asked to be a board member on the National Council of Alcoholism this year. So I'm an NCADD board member. I mean, that's just crazy to me. You know, only in my wildest bar stool dreams, would
someday they're going to be coming to me, you know,
because I, you know how you knew everything when you were drinking, you know, you knew everything. You had no open mind because you had an answer for everything. You know, you could be sitting next to a brain surgeon at the bar and, you know, what kind of scalpel you using? You know, what do you use that scalpel for? Yeah, I mean, you always knew more than anybody else about things you didn't understand at all. And you know, I've had an opportunity to do a number of speaking things like this, and it always just humbles me and blows my mind, because, you know, at heart, on my own unaided will, I am a pathetic alcoholic. I'm one of those alcoholics that you just pity or resent. You know, oh, no, here he comes again. Last time he was over here, he fell asleep on the car hood, you know. I hope he doesn't puke in the poinsettias again, you know. I mean, you know, I was just like a pathetic alcoholic. And today there are some really strong things going on in my life, you know. I have an absolute ton of friends. I've got a lot here tonight, you know. My life gets richer and richer. As an active alcoholic, your life is shrinking. It's getting smaller and smaller. You're chopping off anything that gets in the way of your alcoholic drinking. You'll lose friends and families and jobs and apartments. You know, it doesn't matter. You'll chop those things off as your alcoholism gets more and more progressive. You know, your world gets smaller. You isolate more. And you're just part of your own dark world. Recovery is progressive, just like alcoholism is progressive. And what happens is your life gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And because I'm traveling around a lot today, I've gone from having a home group in Bernardsville that, you know, I'm attached to, my God, I hope nothing ever happens to that, to understanding that Alcoholics Anonymous is a worldwide fellowship. You know, I've got people all over the planet that I know in AA. And we're all part of this same support system. You know, we can do together what we just can't do ourselves. And, you know, this is an amazing thing. On Bill Wilson's detox bed, the thought crossed his mind that, hey, these steps are so important. This Oxford Group principle of rejuvenation, or whatever they called it back then, is so important that, you know, it's able to sober up drunks. I know it is. I'm going to carry this to as many alcoholics as I can. I bet you there's millions out there that are dying. And on Bill Wilson's detox bed, he made the decision to put all of this stuff together. He was a very far-seeing man, to put all this stuff together and dedicate the rest of his life to carrying this message to those who still suffer from alcoholism. And I, for one, am incredibly grateful that he did. This is the first group I've ever seen with the 12 concepts. I love this. This is not normal. You guys are all right. I especially love the part down at the bottom where you can't have any punitive action against AA members, you know, because if you could punitively punish AA members, they would have put me in jail in my first year, you know. Oh, man. Anyway, listen, it's absolutely been a blast being here tonight. Thank you all for coming.